Okay, so a lot goes into writing a sermon, right? There's all kinds of study and preparation and prayer, and you know, God does such a good job of giving you kind of all kind of pieces in the midst of it that speak to what you're studying. And so I got to tell you about one of the pieces that maybe at first glance doesn't sound so spiritual and yet heavily influenced the talk for today. So I'm just going to get that out of the way, and then we'll let that sort of be a lens in the background. But I was at an event on Monday night where I met Carlton Cuse. Does anybody know who that is? No. Co-writer of Lost? I know. That's what I'm talking about. You know, it... something about that show was like so deeply impactful for me. And if you're lucky, and if we can pull it off tech-wise, I might show a little clip here towards the end. But Lost, especially season one, is about something really deep. And I think that this idea of redemption, right? Redemption, just this powerful force that we're longing for. Everybody is longing for it. So you watch a show like that, like Lost, and yeah, you got this weird island and these kind of polar bears and all this like weird sort of sci-fi stuff, and yet you've got this group of people that crashed there on a plane that are all lost. They're all longing for something. There's a wound in there that needs healing. And so anyway, so Lost has been just sort of in the background here, and I was thinking, if this sermon was an episode, but many of these episodes start with what? What's the first thing you see? Does anybody know? Any Lost fans? An eyeball, right? And so, and it comes in real close, and then it's going to pull back, and you're kind of going, whose eye? And this is going to be the window through which you are going to see this episode. And if today's sermon was an episode of Lost, it would start with the eye of Judas. And Judas is a fascinating character, somebody that we know, somebody that I think that we often mistakenly hold at arm's length. We know Judas is the betrayer, and we look at him and we think, glad I'm not that guy, right? Why did Judas do what he did? Well, he was a bad guy. But I don't think that's how Jesus saw him. And I don't think that's how we are supposed to interact with Judas. Before we go any further, I read this goofy book by this guy, Steve Johnson, who writes for Wired, and he's kind of a tech guy, and he wrote this book, Why Everything Bad is Good for You. And he's talking about like why video games and television make us smarter. I know, this kids, pay attention to this. This is... He's saying, you know, television, it used to be that you had one plot line, right? You just kind of focused on the good guy and walked all the way through the episode on that guy. And then, you know, it kind of got a little bit more complex, and you might actually flash over, and here's the bad guy, and this is what the bad guy's doing. So now you've got these two threads, and then you start bringing in other elements. Now it's getting gradually more and more complex until you have these shows like, say, 24. They plot out the threads in 24, and there's like 25 things going on, right? And you're flashing in between all of these things and saying, it's amazing that the mind can kind of keep up with all of these threads. See how Lost keeps speaking into this passage for me, but we've got in our chapter today all these threads in our story. Jesus is in Jerusalem. We're nearing the very end, and what we're going to find in this one short chapter is all these things going on, all these things that are happening, all these characters involved, all these different storylines, and we're going to see them all kind of radically intersect here in this passage. So, again, there's my little reach. But if you would open your Bibles to Matthew 26, and in just a sec, we'll go through and identify the threads here. But remember again, it's Judas's eye that we're going to be looking at this through. Matthew 26, you guys there? When Jesus had finished all these sayings, he just finished the discourse on the Mount of Olives, he said to his disciples, "You know that after 2 days the Passover is coming, and the Son of Man will be delivered up to be crucified. Switch. Then the chief priests and the elders of the people gathered in the palace of the high priest, whose name was Caiaphas, and plotted together in order to arrest Jesus by stealth and kill him. But they said, not during the feast, lest there be an uproar among the people. Now when Jesus was at Bethany in the house of Simon the leper, a woman came up to him with an alabaster flask of very expensive ointment. And she poured it on his head as he reclined at the table. And when the disciples saw it, they were indignant, saying, why this waste? This could have been sold for a large sum and given to the poor. But Jesus, aware of this, said to them, why do you trouble the woman? For she has done a beautiful thing to me. For you always have the poor with you, but you will not always have me. In pouring this ointment on my body, she has done it to prepare me for burial. Truly I say to you, wherever this gospel is proclaimed in the whole world, what she has done will also be told in memory of her. Then one of the 12, whose name was Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and said, what will you give me if I deliver him over to you? And they paid him 30 pieces of silver. And from that moment, he sought an opportunity to betray him. This is the word of the Lord. Threads. First obvious is Jesus. And Jesus has been speaking to his disciples and saying, hey, I'm going to Jerusalem to what? To die. I'm going to Jerusalem to be crucified. This is the plan he realizes fully. You know, I tend to think that Jesus, in understanding his destiny, I think some of it came in gradually to him. I think that like the full omniscience was one of the things that Jesus had handed off when he emptied himself. I think that just because his first miracle, the water to the wine, he tells his mom, I don't think I'm supposed to do that. And then the father says, no, do it. And Jesus says, okay, I'll do it. Whatever the case may be, there's this realization now Jesus is aware. He knows what's ahead of him. He's telling them. But the disciples just continue to miss it, right? They have got a very different agenda. The disciples, each being kind of their own little thread. And in different gospels, we still find them the night of Jesus' arrest bickering. Who's going to be the greatest in Jesus' kingdom? See, each of those 12 guys is committed to following Jesus, but all of them with a little bit different expectation. Something having to do with their achievement, with their success, with their becoming who they long to be. But we know Peter's wearing a sword at this time, and Peter the zealot still sees a fight coming. And he's swearing to Jesus, I'll never betray you. We've got James and John sending their mom to Jesus going, hey, can my sons have the seats of honor, right? So you have all this complexity within Jesus' kind of inner circle. Each of these guys desires something different. And then you have the chief priests that see the growing popularity of this man. They see the threat that he is to their kingdom, their religious institution. And so these guys are figuring out how to do, and they're in a tricky spot, because if there's a riot, then all of a sudden Rome cares. If they could keep things under the radar, well, they can get away with quite a bit. But the second you have something like a riot, now you've got soldiers stepping in. And so they're trying to balance this out. How can we get rid of Jesus without causing strife amongst the people so that they riot, so now soldiers, and now we've lost our power. We've lost control. We've got this woman that comes in here that in Matthew's gospel is unnamed, but most likely is Mary. John gives us that bit of information. She's going to be like our shining bright light in this story. Mary is going to walk into the midst and do something so right and so pure that Jesus says that will never be forgotten. And then you have Judas. Judas isn't named here either, but John tells us, ah, Judas. Judas the treasurer. Judas the one who had track of the books. Judas was the one who looked at what this woman does and says, what a waste. What a total waste of money. You know what we could have done with this? We could have fed the poor. She breaks this vial of nard. I think it's this Indian perfume that costs thousands of dollars. She puts it on Jesus, and she doesn't just put a drop, which is kind of all it would have taken. A couple drops on his forehead, something like that, to anoint him. She just breaks this thing over him, drenches him in this perfume. This radical act, and it causes something inside Judas to well up. And he responds in such an interesting way. I was listening to this talk. Any of you guys listen to TED? TED is this website where, you know, different people share like these 18-minute talks on different things. And this guy was talking about morality, and he was saying, why do people cheat? Which is a good question. Why do people cheat? One of our intuitive responses is to go, well, because they're cheaters, bad people cheat. And he's saying, well, okay, that's interesting. They kind of test that hypothesis. The other one that they test is that what deters people from cheating is this sort of cost-benefit analysis. Like if you're going to speed on the freeway, you're thinking, well, how much time is it going to save me versus what's a speeding ticket going to cost and do I already have a point on my record and, you know, that kind of thing. And that's how we kind of come to the decision whether or not we're going to cheat, whether or not we're going to break the rules. And in this talk, he's saying, you know, it turns out both of those things on a basic intuitive level are not true. That bad people don't cheat. People cheat. They ran these tests. Okay, I'll just give you like the first little one that was so interesting. They gave the people this test. They said, here's 10 math problems. Not difficult. Anybody could do them. You get a dollar for each one you get right. Except they only gave them like 5 minutes to do it. So it turns out they're like having to kind of rush through this. And so then turn in your tests at the end. And how many did you get right? And they said the average was four questions right. And then they said, well, okay, now we're going to run the test again. Same test, everything's the same, except go ahead, take your test, fold it up, put it in your pocket, come up and tell us how many did you get right? 7. And the guy was saying, you know, it's not that like bad people cheat a lot, it's that everybody cheats a little. And that everybody has this sort of built-in fudge factor. And this is the guiding principle, and this is interesting, and this is going to relate, I hope, to Judas. That we cheat based on what we think we can get away with in our own minds and still rationalize that we're a good person. Because all of us wants to think of ourselves as good. Are you a cheater? Gosh, no. Do you cheat? Well, no, right? Okay, maybe this one time, but gosh, you know what? Anybody would have cheated if they were in my shoes, right? And so you see how the mind, this powerful force that we have inside of us, does a wonderful job of convincing ourselves that what we are doing is okay. And Judas stands up there and he looks at this act and he goes, I would have used that money for the poor. And my hunch is he believes it. But John, interestingly enough, if you go to his story, says, but you want to know something? Judas was stealing money out of the poor box. Judas is the treasurer. Judas, the one that, like, kept charge of the accounts. I don't know how John knew that. Maybe he caught him one time. Maybe they were wondering where the money went, and Judas always had some good reason, like, oh, you know what? Actually, gas prices were a little high there, so whatever it was, he always had some way maybe of rationalizing it, but whatever the case was, Judas was stealing from Jesus, which I think is really interesting. Why would you steal from Jesus? Right? Here's the guy who's proven he can do anything. Takes loaf and fish and feeds 5,000 people. And I think what this does, and hopefully for all of us, it invites us in to his story. What is it that created maybe a fear inside of himself? That, you know what, this guy, he's promising all these things, but I need a backup plan. I'm investing in Jesus. He's going to be the new king. I'm on board with that. But just in case it doesn't quite go the way I'm hoping, I'm going to take an extra $20 and stick it in my pocket. Maybe that was it. Maybe underneath it, he didn't think that Jesus really had his best interest in mind. As he's listening to all this teaching, he's saying, yeah, it's a good point, but he doesn't totally get my situation. And maybe he was going out and spending it on some form of self-medication because of some sadness that was inside of him, some wound. I keep mentioning this guy, Richard Rohr. He said something that I thought was really interesting. He was saying that all of us, and this is probably oversimplified, so if you're a psychologist or psychiatrist, don't beat me up for this. But he was saying, you know, I think we're all about like one-third a product of our environment, about one-third genetics, and about one-third choice, free will. And guaranteed there was something that had happened to Judas, because there's something that's happened to every single one of us, right? A wound. Something inside of us that desperately needs to be redeemed. And something that probably in the end is not our fault. But what we do to take care of that wound is we try to treat it ourselves. And this is where our choice and our ego and the fallen nature of man gets in. And starts coming up with our own plans, our own ways of solving this, our own ways of taking care of this. And so it conveniently feeds this ego need at the same time that it's trying to treat a necessary wound. And this is where Judas goes wrong. He has this hidden sin, but my goodness, who doesn't? Right? How many of us have that thing that we look at and we think it's no big deal? That little indiscretion that's in the shadows that nobody sees that we get away with. And we think, no worries, I'm not harming anybody. Guaranteed, whoever caught Judas stealing, Judas would have been able to rationalize it right away and say, ah, you know what, I'm taking this for this reason. And here's where we see our mind trying to hold things together. In James chapter 1, it says, if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given him. But let him ask in faith with no doubting, for the one who doubts is like the wave of the sea, driven and tossed by the wind. That person must not suppose he will receive anything from the Lord. He is double-minded, unstable in all his ways. And I think this is what we see in Judas. Is what can be described as duplicity. He's fighting for these two sort of ideals. He's trying to serve God. He's trying to serve man. He's trying to be on board with Jesus' team and also look out for himself. And I love that picture of a wave tossed about. We think we're not harming anyone when really inside of us, in our souls, we're creating a state of distress. I was reading this article by a lady, she was a therapist, that not a Christian, but writing, saying, you know, I'm sick and tired of hearing couples come in here, or not couples, but couples in crisis, where one of them says, you know, this affair, it just happened. And she's going, my goodness, nothing just happens. Nothing just happens. That every little action, every little thing, every little hidden desire of the heart, all of these things end up, in the end, steering this ship in a direction where it becomes harder and harder to turn. And Judas, as he's stealing this money, as he's medicating this wound, as he's, you know, whatever it is that he's doing that for, is creating this rut, this pattern, what Scripture defines, I think, as a stronghold in his life. It's changing who he is. It's making it so that his ability to choose other than that is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. Do you know this? Neurologically speaking, as we like make decisions like that, our brain starts forming these grooves in it in which the little impulses travel now along this canyon. Meaning if we want to respond different, our brain is like stuck in a rut. And it can be changed. It can be changed through the will. It can be changed through prayer. It can be changed through the mind, through renewing of the mind. But the more we get caught up in these little behaviors, the more that we lose our freedom. Luke 16, 10 through 13 says, "One who is faithful in a very little is also faithful in much. One who is dishonest in a very little is also dishonest in much. If then you have not been faithful in the unrighteous wealth, who will entrust to you the true riches? If you have not been faithful in that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? No servant can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money." And in Luke's gospel, another thread enters into the picture. If you watch Lost, this is like the black smoke coming in. The devil. And it says at this moment, the devil comes and enters into Judas. Here, I'll just read it for you. "Then Satan entered into Judas, called Iscariot, who was of the number of the 12. And he went away and conferred with the chief priests and officers how he might betray him to them. And they were glad and agreed to give him money. So he consented and sought an opportunity to betray him in the absence of a crowd." Isn't that creepy? It reminds me of Job. Remember in Job where God says to Job, "Have you considered Job?" And Satan's going, "Oh yeah, I've considered Job, and there's no weakness. There's no way in. You've put a hedge around him. You've protected him. The guy, like, has integrity. There's no way in." And here you see the devil lurking in the shadows. And what's he looking for? Opportunity. Where our guard is down. Remember when we were studying Nehemiah, and they've got this, and Ezra, and they've got this wall that's largely intact, and yet it's got these holes. And it doesn't matter if you have 99% of that wall intact, the enemy's going to find the little 1% where they can get through. And it's interesting, you know, I mean, how long has Satan been watching this pattern in Judas? And going, "I'm going to save that one." He holds that card, and he's waiting to play it because, see, Satan has got a whole different agenda in here. Well, an agenda that goes right along the lines with the chief priests, but for his own reason. He's seen the Messiah, and he wants to win. And so Satan's way of winning is going to be either to ruin the reputation of Jesus or to kill him. And I think this is funny. Jesus is there to die, and everybody's trying to kill him. Hey, okay, allow me one little Lord of the Rings bit here, but I love how they go. The enemy has no idea that they would come destroy the ring, because that would never enter his mind, right? That's their advantage, because that kind of power, it just can't even comprehend that somebody would lay down their own life. And so here you have all these people rushing to fulfill the thing that Jesus is there to do. Brilliant. But he sees his opportunity. And I think sometimes we see, do you see what I'm getting at, where I'm going with this? That we look at the ruin of Judas Iscariot and we think, guy, betrayer. But the betrayal almost is like happening apart from him. What is Judas guilty of? Stealing over and over again. Creating a weakness, creating an opportunity, and then being exploited, being ruined by the devil. As I said, Jesus' plans are not in jeopardy here. That all of these people, whether they know it or not, are working towards some divine plan, some divine purpose. And this is a great thing about how sovereignty works. I've used this before, but Lewis talks about the simple good, the simple evil, and the complex good. There are things that are simple good, simple acts of obedience. There are things that are simple evil, stealing, let's say. And the complex good is God coming in and exploiting the evil. I like that. The enemy's best efforts, all that he can do, the worst he can throw, and what God does is he exploits it and uses it for glory, uses it for his purposes. This is how in control he is, that within all of this, he's saying, nothing can thwart my plans. Nothing can thwart the will of God. This is how sin can stay evil and yet be turned to the good. You ever wonder why Jesus let Judas handle the money? I think that's interesting. Why would Jesus hand him the wallet? He knows Judas has got to struggle with this. And I think this is an amazing thing, and we'll see this through the rest of the thing. Jesus cares so much about this guy, loves him, all the way to the end. When Judas finally hangs himself in total despair, I think Jesus' heart is so broken by that. Jesus sees how this life has been ruined, this man that he loves. And as he gives him this wallet, gives him this money, like Jesus is saying, you can do it, Judas. You can do it. There's a possibility for you to have that wound healed, to receive my love. There's a possibility for you to hear and to turn. So Jesus trusts him, knowing that he's making mistakes, hoping that in the end, not that he's not going to stop making mistakes, but the thing that's driving him, the thing that's driving Judas, will actually receive the healing love of God. I want to talk a little bit about Mary, because I think she's intentionally juxtaposed with him. It's interesting that what she triggers in him is this angry response. He's offended. How dare she waste all that money that we could have given to the poor? I think that Mary, in her act of purity and singularity and just total devotion and worship, ends up revealing to Judas his own heart. What she does is like light in the darkness. And darkness is exposed, and that thing he's holding inside that he's hiding is like, oh, there it is. And have you ever experienced that? Maybe just me. When that happens, you want to attack. You want to defend. You want to get on your guard. You cling to some virtue. I would use that for the poor. Instead of letting that conviction hit, settle in. Instead of him going, oh my gosh, I never would have done that because I'm so hooked on this greed for this money that I can't worship Jesus like Mary. And instead of being like, how dare she? Judas there has the opportunity to fall on his knees and worship as well. Instead, he rallies everybody to his side. Here's a little Richard Rohr. He says, when the negative presence is revealed, false innocence is denied, and true victory is offered. This situation, this moment, one of the elements of it may be just right there for Judas. Light. Purity. Mary's good at this. Remember with her sister, Martha in the kitchen? It almost sets the stage for this, right? Martha's so busy and at work, and here's Mary in devotion, and she does it again. You know, this may possibly have been a dowry of hers. Whatever it was, that this was probably for Mary, her security. It would have been her backup plan. She has this perfume that's worth a lot of money, a year's wages, I think it says. And you know what she could have done with it is she could have come in and put a couple drops on Jesus and anointed him. But she does it head and feet, which means she just spills this over him. It must have reeked in that room. Be like a whole bottle of cologne all over Jesus, drenching him in this. And what I think is so cool, all right, I'm speculating again, but I wonder if Mary had any idea what she was doing. I tend to think maybe she didn't. Nobody else seemed to get it, and maybe she did, but maybe she just loved Jesus that much that she went, "This is everything I have, and I'm just pouring it out all over you, Jesus, everything." I love that in Jeremiah 29:11. It says, 11 through 13, "I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans for welfare, not for evil, to give you a future hope, to give you a future and a hope. Then you will call upon me and come and pray to me, and I will hear you. You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart." And what's cool is Jesus says, "You want to know what she did? She just prepared me for burial." And she was like, "I did?" Well, I don't know. I don't know if that was her response, but I tend to think it was. And see, this is to me, I think, what's so cool about this. God's going to take the disobedience of Judas. He's going to turn it and exploit it so that he is going to go to the cross where he is supposed to go, to die and to rise again for victory. God will take and exploit the simple evil of a Judas or of the devil or of the high priests. God also takes the simple good and does so much more with it than we could even imagine. Mary, I'm guessing, had no desire for recognition when she did this. If she did, this would not be the kind of moment that we're celebrating here. But she comes in this truly just honest, simple obedience to her heart that is just totally in love with Jesus. And I think Jesus looks at her and goes, "You have no idea what you just did. That will never be forgotten." I find that so motivating that Jesus is saying to each of us, not just stop fiddling with disobedience. Stop going down that path. Stop ruining your life. But he's saying in these simple acts of devotion, of worship, of obedience to God, we have the opportunity to feed the 5,000. We have the opportunity to take that simple good and have God magnify it far beyond what we can imagine. I think someday we'll see it, but not until someday. Philippians 4:18, I love this. Paul says to the Philippians, "I received full payment and more. I'm well supplied, having received from Epaphroditus the gifts you sent, a fragrant offering, a sacrifice acceptable and pleasing to God." I love that fragrant offering, and fragrance is like right at the heart of this aroma of the kingdom. And this is, I think, what worship is, as we come here on a Sunday and join together and sing, and our hearts are lifted up, is us pouring out this, what we have to give to God, simple gesture of obedience, and yet something that he, like, goes, "Oh, thank you. It smells beautiful." When we think of Judas, I think our hearts should be filled with pity. He was swindled. He was ruined by the devil. I think that we must be careful not to hold him at arm's length, which is, I think, what we oftentimes want to do. We hold him at arm's length so we don't have to deal with our junk, our wound, our hidden sin. We can conveniently leave that at bay and go on playing our game. Luke 18, 9 through 14, it says, "The Pharisee standing by himself prayed thus, 'God, I thank you I'm not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week, I give tithes of all that I get.' But the tax collector, standing far off, would not even lift up his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, 'God, be merciful to me, a sinner.' I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but the one who humbles himself will be exalted." And all of us, like in that TED talk, all of us have this fudge factor, the sin that we let ourselves get away with. The sin that allows, and maybe the actions that accompany it that make us think, I'm a good person after all. And this concept that we have that saints are the ones who need the least grace, right? Gosh, that person is a saint. They barely need God. When in fact, like Dallas Willard says, saints are the ones who consume the most grace. They consume the most. They're like that tax collector that says, "Have mercy on me." They're like Mary, emptying herself of everything at the feet of Jesus. They're the ones that receive. They're the ones that shine. Do you want to see this clip from Lost? It's my favorite one. Can I set the stage real quick? Oh, sorry, Sawyer with his shirt off, only for a second. Jack, the leader. This is about Jack and his dad. And Jack is driven, and we see all this stuff. Jack has got a huge wound. But when I tell you about redemption here, anyway, that's all I'll say. Go ahead and play it. Oh, is there volume?
About a week before we all got on the plane, I got to talking to this man at a bar in Sydney. He was an American too. Doctor. I've been on some benders in my time, but this guy was going for an all-time record. It turns out this guy has a son. Son's a doctor too. They'd had some kind of big time falling out. The guy knew it was his fault. No, his son's back in the States thinking the same damn thing. See, kids are like dogs. Knock them around enough, I think they did something to deserve it. Anyway, there's a payphone in this bar, and this guy, Christian, he tells me he wishes he had the stones to pick up the phone and call his kid. Tell him he's sorry. He's a better doctor than he'll ever be. He's proud. He loves him. I had to take off, but something tells me he never got around to making that call. Small world, huh? Yeah. Good luck.
kidding me? That's so good. I love it because it brings this hard, strong guy to this place of such softness, right? And I think that sometimes that sort of pride is what is there and is that barrier, control, ego, whatever that is, that makes us unwilling to receive, unwilling to trust, unwilling to believe. And that father wound that Jack has, I think, is often very symbolic of the father wound that we have towards our Heavenly Father. And Jesus is saying, come in there. Let me come in there. Let me come in there and fix that. Let me come in there and just receive my love. Receive my grace. Right there at that place of vulnerability where our guard is up, where our calluses are thick. I think that's offered to Judas, and I think he misses it. I think that was offered to Mary, and her life is radically transformed by it. And it begins, I think, in our minds by finding the lies, by letting God expose those things. Do you have that quote by Tozer? I'll read it for you. That our idea of God correspond as nearly as possible to the true being of God is of immense importance to us compared to our actual thoughts about Him. Our doctrinal statements are of little consequence. Our real idea of God may lie buried under the rubbish of conventional religious notions and may require an intelligent and vigorous search before it is finally unearthed and exposed for what it is. Only after an ordeal of painful self-probing are we likely to discover what we actually believe about God. A right conception of God is basic, not only to systematic theology, but to practical Christian living as well. It is to worship what the foundation is to the temple. Where it is adequate or out of plumb, the whole structure must sooner or later collapse. I believe there is scarcely an error in doctrine or a failure in applying Christian ethics that cannot be traced finally to imperfect and ignoble thoughts about God. This by Henry Nouwen, success, popularity, and power can indeed present a great temptation, but their seductive quality often comes from the way they are part of a much larger temptation of self-rejection. We have come to believe in the voices that call us worthless and unlovable. Then success and popularity and power are easily perceived as attractive solutions to our desolate condition. Jesus says in John, all who received him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. And that we love him because he first loved us. And as we close the service, a couple thoughts. You know, as we come forward and have time for prayer, that may be a healthy time to confess something that's in the dark and bring it into the light and let it wither. I love this in Ephesians. It says, take no part in unfruitful works of darkness, but instead expose them. It is shameful even to speak of the things that they do in secret, but when anything is exposed by the light, it becomes visible. For anything that becomes visible is light. And God wants to come in and transform those areas for you to receive his love there, receive his forgiveness, receive his grace. But it requires bringing those things into the light. And we'll have people down here that would love to pray with you about any of those things. I love how Tozer is saying, gosh, this is the foundation of worship. And as we come into worship, oftentimes the things that are preventing us from fully entering in are these things that we clutch onto. So I thought we would close with a worship song. I'm going to have Billy come up here, and I'm asking him to sing this song that we used to sing at camp like 4 or 5 years ago. Just kidding, like 20 years ago. At Forest Home, my goodness, that was a long time ago. It's this really simple song that he could teach us, but it's the song Billy, I was saying, oh, we need to close with a worship song this Sunday. And he said, well, what song? And I was like, oh, just pick one. And he's like, well, is there any song that stands out? And I was like, you know what? This is the song that's been going through my head the whole time I've been working on this talk. It's a really simple song, but I think it's a song about giving our whole heart. So anyway, Billy will teach it to us, and when we're done, Lauren will close our message.